last we were speaking about Rav Avadya Yosef, and I gave you my thoughts that I said that according to Rav Avadya, the way I read him, if someone were to move to Israel or someone living in Israel and decide that he wanted to become a Sephardi, we were talking about this around Pesach time, and start eating kitnios and everything like that, that Rav Avadya publicly says Ashkenazim have to remain Ashkenazim, but if you went to him privately, I said that he would tell you privately, yes, you can become a Sephardi, because the land of Israel is the territory of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, and therefore, according to his logic, he argues throughout his writings, you should be able to become a Sephardi. Is that you, Shalom, playing around with it? Okay. If the screen goes off, it'll be back on in a minute. We're still getting used to this. So I wanted to test this theory out, which I think makes perfect sense, judging from what he says in many places. And I wrote to some of his sons. One of his sons I wrote to is Rav Yitzhak Yosef, author of many volumes of Yalkut Yosef and author of the new book, Ein Yitzhak, three volumes of various Klolim ideas on Shas. And he wrote me back a letter. Here's the letter. Happy to send it to anyone. My letter with his comments on the side. And he says, we never said such a thing ever. It's obvious that if an Ashkenazi is in Israel, he cannot become Sephardi. However, he continues, if he becomes a Baal Tshuva in Israel, then since he didn't have any Mesorah, then he can become a Sephardi and everything, and the good and the bad. He can eat kitnios and everything else. By the way, in his book, Ein Yitzchak, he says the same thing about if you become a Baal Tshuva, you can become a Sephardi. So I was a little upset, you know, here my reading of Rav Avadya is shown to be wrong by the son, Rav Yitzhak Yosef, probably the next chief rabbi of Jerusalem. But look, the truth is most important, that's why I wrote to him. Yet, about 3 days after Rav Avadya's son, Rav Yitzhak, after 3 days after I received his letter, I get another letter in the mail. This time, from Rav Avraham Yosef, chief rabbi of Cholon. Now, we spoke, if you recall, last semester, how with Pesach, with the Bamba snacks, Rav Avraham Yosef's two leading sons, Rav David Yosef, the Rav of Har Nof, an author of the multi-volume Halacha Brura, says you make a bracha, one bracha on it, I think he says Mazonos, or maybe I'm confused, and the other son, Rav Yitzhak, says you make another bracha, Hadama, I think that's what it is. They have different opinions, and each one of their Sfarim has the approbation of their father. So what the father says, who knows? My spirits were raised because in this letter from Rav Avraham Yosef, he says exactly what I said. That, yes, if an Ashkenazi in Israel wants to practice like a Sephardi, Lakua or a Chumra, he is absolutely permitted. So, I don't know what to say. Maybe when Menachem Butler is in Israel next and he goes to visit Maran, he can ask him, but I don't know. It could be a thing that every day you ask him, he gives you a different answer, because this illustrates better than anything this whole conflict with the Bamba that Rav Avadya has, seems, because I'm assuming each son asked their father or is following their father's positions. Okay, one more comment before we begin. We spoke about fasting, and how I mentioned that in the Haredi world, especially the Hasidic world, women really don't fast. It's Menachem says he doesn't eat Bamba. Okay. No, there's no Mashiach's son. Rav Yaakov Yosef, who's the extremist, who disagrees with everything his father says, he has signed some letter for the Chabad, but he's not a real Mashiachist. So I mentioned that in the Haredi world, it's funny, because the Haredi world is supposed to be the frum world, but in the Haredi world, certain things are not as frum. For example, women generally don't daven, even though according to the standard halachas, women are supposed to daven, and fasting. Women basically don't fast, and I mentioned that certainly the three little fasts they don't, and even Tisha B'Av, they're very lenient on the fast. And a few months ago, this book came out, Teshuvos VaHanhagos of Rav Moshe Sternbach, Volume 5. And listen to this quote. This is in Siman Kuftzad Bet, quoting Rabbi Fisher, Yisrael Fisher, the former Av Beis Din of the Eda Haredi, who says, and this is a halacha l'maisa question, pregnant women no pregnant women need to fast on Yom Kippur until the ninth month. Until the end of the ninth month, when they're ready to give birth, they don't need to fast at all. So here you have, when I say extreme, I'm talking about the Eda Chareti, a lot more, quote, from than your local modern Orthodox or YU rabbi, and he decides, halacha lamaisa, that no pregnant woman needs to fast on Yom Kippur. And you're going to say what the Shulchan Aruch says differently. The answer is that today we're much weaker. And since we're very weak today, every pregnant woman can eat on Yom Kippur. Let me give you one more thing before we start. We spoke a good deal about Parsha Zachar. This is going back a ways, and I spoke to you about the history of Parsha Zachar and how now we read for women, we make minyonim, and how Rav Nosson Adler was the originator of this. In the new volume of Mishnah Halachot of Rabbi Menashe Klein, those who want to check it can see it. It's in number 92. He goes off and how this is a terrible, terrible thing, that we're going to give a special minyan for women for Parsha Zachar. This is something new. We never heard of it before. And he has a point. Why should we make a new thing for Parsha Zachar for women if no one ever did it in history? But then he goes on, even for Tkiyas HaShofar, we don't do anything new. Okay, let's leave it with that. I have more stuff, but we'll get to it in future classes. Those of you who signed up would have seen that it said that we're starting with Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan. Really, though, it's a continuous course. It's Rav Fisher. Yaakov Yisrael Fisher. He was the Abbasin of the Eda Charedit. Thank you for that article. Really, we're in a continuation of previous classes, so we still have at least three quarters, maybe even one more class to do, of Avram Shapiro, the late chief rabbi of the State of Israel, Rosh Hashiva of Merkaz Harav. So those who are interested can go hear the previous lectures on it. It's not Sternbach. It's Sternbach quoting Fisher. Fisher was his predecessor as the Av Beis Din, Rosh Av Beis Din. I'm going to pick up right where I left off. And as I said, those who are interested can go back to the previous classes. We're about three-quarters of the way done of Rav Avram Shapiro. And I ended by an amazing story Rav Avram Shapiro tells. After the February 1917 revolution that brings Kerensky to power, the Orthodox in Russia formed a group called Masoret V'Cherut. And it contained Zionists and non-Zionists. They were supposed to send a delegation to the All-Russian Jewish Congress, which never took place because of the Bolshevik Revolution. And this was supposed to be a real political power. Now, over 50 rabbis came to Moscow in 1917 for discussions about this group. The Chafetz Chaim sent regrets that he couldn't come, but among the rabbis were of Avram Shapiro of Kovno, the great Devar Avraham, Rav Avram Burstein, one of the great Rosh Yeshiva, not that well known today, Rav Yitzhak Isaac Rabinovich of Ponovej, Rav Itzela of Ponovej, Rav Aaron Volkin of Pinsk, who was killed in the Holocaust, and many other great groups. Now, great rabbis. One of the issues that came up was the following, and this was being discussed in Russian society as a whole. Until the revolution, property was held by the Tsar and by the various princes and elites, the rich people, the magnates. And there was all the talk about redistribution of land. We can understand that. And one of the issues that this new group was going to have to take a stand on, Masoret V'Cherut, was the issue of redistribution. Because now it was possible not just to take the land of the Tsar, but to take the land that belonged to the nobles and the princes and redistribute it. And this is what the average people wanted. However, is this in accord with Jewish law? After all, Jewish law recognizes private property. Can you just go and take someone's property? And this was a subject of great controversy by the rabbis. And as can be imagined, many opposed this step. They thought it was gezeila. You're stealing property from people. Rav Yehuda Leib Graubart, later an important rav in Toronto, In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the second Erev in North America, third Erev in North America, after St. Louis and New York, is in Toronto. And if you look in Rabbi Graubart's Sefer, Chavalim Bin Imim, he discusses it. He was a Mizrahi Rav, a Rav of great erudition and interesting Sfarim. I think most of them are on HebrewBooks.org. He wrote a book called Sefer HaZikaron, also on HebrewBooks.org. And it's vital information about the history of Orthodoxy in Russia. And he records all sorts of interesting stuff. On the Sfarim blog, I quoted some of his most fascinating material. But he quotes Rav Itzel, and he was involved in this group. He was one of the leaders. Rav Itzel gets up, and as recorded by Rav Graubart, says as follows, quote, "It is necessary for us, that is the rabbis, to get involved on the political side. And through it, we will bring the young and bring the streets to our group. We see that the Jewish people want this. That is, the Jewish people want redistribution of the land. And this is certainly from God. And the people of Israel are higher and more exalted than the Gedolei Torah. Israel, if they are not prophets, they are sons of prophets." In other words, if the Jewish people think that the concentration of land in the hands of the minority is unjust and should be redistributed, even if the rabbis claim that redistribution of the land is robbery, the opinion of the Jewish people overrides that of the rabbis. This is in direct opposition to the Haredi notion that the views of the Baal HaBatim are directly opposed to Das Torah. Rav Avram Shapiro quotes this text. He was asked what the Jewish view of Das Torah is. In the Haredi world, Das Torah is that you have a few rabbis, I call it a papal vision of Judaism, where they make all the decisions for their followers. Rav Avram Shapiro quoted Rav Itzel as saying that in certain matters, the masses, the people, override the rabbis. And there is he develops this, and there's a Das Torah among the people. Rav Avram admits that this is a great chiddush, and it's certainly difficult to apply it to other cases, especially today when the masses are not religious. But in a religious society, when the average Jew is a religious Jew, there is, he says, a concept of Das Torah of believers. And this, first of all, has to be taken into account by the rabbis when they examine an issue. And two, they can override the rabbis. This is actually identical, or just about identical, to the Catholic notion of sensus fidelium, the sense of the faithful, the Catholic notion that the faithful community is a transmitter of divine will. And we have the texts, Inenam Navim, B'nei Navim Haim, Kol Hamon, Kekol Shaddai. There's all sorts of texts that can be used to support this in traditional rabbinic literature. Why it's significant is that it's in direct opposition to the Haredi view of Das Torah, which, as I said, quotes this text, I think it's in the Taz, that the views of the masses are, by definition, against Das Torah. And it also shows there of Avram Shapiro, while not rejecting the notion of Das Torah, had a much wider understanding of it. You know, I always laugh when I hear about this. You know, they if you look in the Haredi literature, they say that the views of the masses are against Das Torah, which means that the masses can't understand Das Torah. And that makes sense, if you want to say, you know, the Gedolim are on such a high level, they see things differently like us, so we can't understand it, therefore we shouldn't even mix in. But then it reaches absurdities when you have their spokesmen, people like Jonathan Rosenblum and others, who try to explain these Das Torahs and make it more palatable. Well, that doesn't make any sense, because Jonathan Rosenblum and the rest, they're Baal HaBatim, so they can't understand it. The Gedolim have already said they can't understand it, so why should they even try to make it palatable when it's basic to the doctrine of Das Torah that it's not palatable, that it's not something that the average person can understand? But Rav Avram disagrees. He doesn't use the phrase. He says exactly what I said. He quotes Rav Itzel, and he says that the Klal Yisrael, Das Torah, is found in Klal Yisrael. And he says this is a great chiddush, which needs to be developed. I'm pointing out that you have these texts that could be used for this, for such a notion. He doesn't tell you how far to go with it. What does that mean? I mean, don't we go to the rabbis to ask them what the halacha is? But we have examples. We have plenty of examples, if you want to speak historically here, of where the Gedolim, the poskim, yelled and screamed and said, what you're doing is usur, it's forbidden. And the people refused to listen. And in the next generation, or the generation after that, the poskim then had to be melamed zchus. Because there's the principle that if the people are doing something and they don't change, Rav Kook develops this also, there must be a good reason, even if they didn't realize it. And therefore, the job of the rabbis is to be melamed zchus, to find some justification. You see this over and over again. And not just famous cases like Chadosh, but over and over again where the people refuse to listen to what the Gedolim are saying, the Poskim, and eventually it becomes common practice. And the next step of the Gedolim is then to justify it ex post facto. It is Catholic Israel, and it's Zachariah Frankel, but it's Rav Kook, and it's Chaim Soloveitchik, and it's Yaakov Katz, and if anyone who's ever studied the history of Halakha works like this to a large extent. The people refuse to listen. They continue to do it, and Ritzitz Eliezer speaks about this. Then the next generation, the assumption being that there's some sort of hashkacha pratis involved here, divine providence, it is justified. We can think of numerous examples in our own day. There are things that the rabbis will tell us, and the community will just say it goes against our ethical sense. If the rabbis are to get up and tell us to do something which they claim is halacha and the masses think is just unethical, the masses will win out. The masses will refuse to do this. And look, there's a lot we could say about this. Let me tell you just about Ravitzula. It's so interesting. The Chasam Sofer himself deals with that. The Chasam Sofer says that any minhag that's been accepted, you can't question it. So what does that mean, any minhag that's been accepted? A lot of these minhagim come from the people, not from the rabbanim. And this ties in. The Chasam Sofer has passages where you see the same thing, that he even has an explicit one, if I remember correctly, that if the people do it, that this is they're being guided by God's providence. If I'm not mistaken, the Chasam Sofer says explicitly. Others definitely say it explicitly, that after the fact we can look at a minhag and see this as having been guided by a certain form of providence, so then you can justify it after the fact. Let me just look quickly at what people wrote. I believe it's Katz's thesis, and it's Minhag Yisrael Torah, there's no question. You have this in the past. Sometimes you have a Minhag where one rabbi will say it's forbidden, and Minhag is the letters of Gehenna, and another rabbi will say, no, we have to justify the practices of the masses. Because if the masses do it, then, and we're not dealing with masses today. We're dealing, as Chaim Soloveitchik points out in his famous article on religious law and change, we're dealing in a pious community. When there was an assumption that if the masses did something, it was religiously sound. We're not talking about a community, first of all, like we have today, that's self-conscious. We're talking about an organic community where people do things naturally. And we're not talking about a community when most people are not religious at all or are influenced by the non-religious. This only worked in a community which was really self-contained, and people were not from the way we think of it today, but they had Jewish, they had a sense, there was a sense of the faithful. People understood what Torah values were. And Zachariah Frankel pointed this out. Someone asked him about his ideology. Does this mean that anything goes? And he said, no, in the days of the Baal, most people worshiping the Baal, that's not how it works. You have to be focusing on a pious community here. Okay, I think it's very interesting. I think you can take the Rav's point, and you can probably connect it to Ravitzula's point and do some very nice stuff with it. I don't think anyone, other than Rav Avraham Shapiro's short comments, no one has really developed this idea, because it would really put you, you'd get in the same situation as the Catholic churches, where you'd have the priests and saying one thing and the community faithful saying something else. You'd create a machlokas. The one person I know of is in Israel. I think it's Yeheskel Cohen from the Torah V'Avoda movement. I think that's his name. I could be wrong. There's some leaders in the Torah V'Avoda movement, which was a big movement in the 50s, who tried to actually argue this point, that we're not going to take orders from the rabbis on every issue, that we are the community, we are a religious community, we have a sense of what Torah values are, and they actually set up their kibbutzim. They didn't even want to have rabbis in their kibbutzim, but they set up their kibbutzim as almost autonomous in this area. If you have an issue that you need to go to the Rav, you go to the Rav. Some of this still continues in the religious intellectuals in Israel, when they have conferences, they don't like to invite rabbis. But there was a small movement that developed this. I don't know. I don't think the Orthodox Forum, which is very rabbi heavy, I don't know if there's anyone who's not a rabbi opposed to it. This is the sort of thing, though, which could perhaps be developed, the sense of the faithful. Historically, there is no question that Katz and Soloveitchik and the rest are correct, that this is how Jewish law has operated. And Rav Kook justifies this halachically in Arpalei Toar, where he says that the rabbis will scream at the masses, but only the people with clear vision, and by that he means himself, will see that this is really being guided by divine providence. We need time to work it out. We don't have time now. So I'm going to have to leave it at that with all these questions. Let me just tell you about Rav Itzela, and there are no consistent rules that I can tell. Rav Itzela was greatly respected by the radicals. In fact, one of his own sons was arrested for revolutionary activities, so he had it in his family. We know that he was greatly interested in socialism and carefully went through Marx's Das Kapital. In fact, Yaakov Mark, who has stories of different Gedolim, he claims that he spoke to Rav Itzela about this, and Rav Itzela told him he's very impressed by Marx, but he says as follows, I cannot agree with his position on that opposes Torah law, namely private property. Now, I don't deny that he said as much to Mark, but as we see from Graubart's book, years later, at the time of the Russian Revolution, he had a different perspective. Now, how Rav Itzela, from a halachic viewpoint, could have supported redistribution of wealth, after all, the Torah supports private property, it's not a difficult problem, because as far as the rabbis are concerned, governments have a right to engage in all sorts of taxation and redistribution of wealth. Rav Henkin has a piece about rent control. I mean, what is rent control, if not telling me, as an owner of private property, that I cannot charge whatever I want to charge? And yet, however misguided government rent control policies are, government has the right, according to Jewish law, to institute such policies, taxation, all sorts of policies. And therefore, if the government decides they're going to redistribute the wealth, Rav Itzela's position was, if that's what the people want, the government can do that. And if it's your private property, it doesn't matter. Government has the right to do that. Now, this is interesting with regard to Rav Avram Shapiro's point we spoke about last class, returning land. Because what about if the people want to return the land? I mentioned how he was very opposed to it, and he said that this is not an issue even in Das Torah. He says this is pure halacha. So let's say the people decide, well, this is the halacha, but who cares? We want to return the land. I don't know if Rav Avram himself was ever consistent, because he did say that it doesn't matter what the people say. You can't return land. And yet, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, in the time of Yamit, said that we can no longer protest this. Even though he thought the people were mistaken, he said, we see the people are not behind us, and therefore we can't protest anymore. The people have made a decision, even though we disagree with it, it's their decision. So I don't really know where to take that. I will say about Rav Avraham, with regard to Das Torah, more points in which he, the idea being again that Rabbanim can make non-halachic decisions, Rav Avram says that no one can require acceptance of Das Torah, no matter how great someone is. Das Torah, rabbinic Das Torah means, I'm not talking about the people's Das Torah, which as we saw, is even more powerful than rabbinic Das Torah. But Rav Avram Shapiro did believe in rabbinic Das Torah. However, he said that it can never come from the top. It only comes from the bottom. People choose to follow a Rav's Das Torah. He can never require it. Again, it's not like the papal pronouncements in Yatei Ne'eman. A certain Rav or his followers can never declare, this is the Das Torah, you must follow it. This is a Rav's opinion. It's not halacha, which people on their own choose to follow. And he also criticized those rabbis who say, who claim to have Das Torah, or their followers claim that they have Das Torah, and yet they published halachic writings, and in their halachic writings, they say on the very first page, these writings are not lamaaseh. They're not for practical purposes. They're just theoretical understandings. So Rav Avram says, in other words, their din Torah is not sufficient. Din Torah is not found with them, and yet they claim to have Das Torah. Rav Avram mocked this phenomenon of where you have Rabbanim, even Gedolim, who don't have din Torah, that is, you can't decide halacha like them, they're not willing to take on their shoulders the burden of halacha, but yet when it comes to, quote, Das Torah, then they're willing to say, this is what Das Torah is. I think these are fascinating points where Avraham Shapiro shows you the Chardal sentiment. Everyone seems to put them in the Haredi camp, with the exception of support for Israel and Zionism, and yet we see here views which are very much in opposition to the Haredi perspective. Rav Avram goes further, and you can find this, incidentally, in an essay in a book called Morasha, which reprinted all of his essays. Okay, let me just... Well, Rav Avram discusses this. So there, you don't see it in the Talmud explicitly, the idea of Das Torah, and obviously the modern Orthodox don't like it. There is an idea, Rav Avram says, of guidance from the Rabbanim. Rav Lichtenstein has an essay about this too. But it can't be binding upon people against their wishes. This is the Haredi innovation, although they don't think it's an innovation. They think they have many different approaches to it. One of the most recent ones I saw, you can find on JewishLaw.com, an essay about this, claims that the rabbis now stand in the place of the Jewish communal government of the past. And communal government was binding, and therefore the rabbis take stand in its place. The problem with this is that never in history did the rabbi have that standing. The rabbi was always regarded as an employee of the communal government. Look in Bonfield's book, for example, on rabbis in Italy. The rabbis couldn't even put someone in Chayrim without the community leaders agreeing. So the community leaders, the Zion Tova Yair, were always the final authority in communities, never the rabbis. So, I don't know, you can come up with all sorts of justifications for it. Rav Avram writes that the rabbinate serves the people. It's not the private possession of the rabbis. See, the rabbis, especially in the Haredi world, are big on the idea that the rabbinate is a Yerusha. It goes from father to son. Rav Moshe Feinstein has chuvas about this. Well, he already recognized that in America, when you become a Rav, you accept the situation in America, that in America rabbis' contracts are renewed and you can be fired and all that. But in the Haredi world, they speak a lot about rabbinate as a Yerusha, and that was traditionally how, in many places, how it was. Rav Avram says, though, that today there's no idea of Yerusha in the rabbinate. The community picks the rabbi that suits them. He goes further. He was asked the following question. Yeshiva Bacher asked him about, the state of Israel, the typical questions that Yeshiva Bacher in the Haredi world ask him. And Rav Avram says as follows. At one time, it was possible to argue whether there should or shouldn't be a state. We're going to see that Rav Hinken, who becomes a big supporter of the state after it comes to be, opposed the creation of the state of Israel. The same thing, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. You can't get a bigger supporter of the State of Israel and of its security than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And yet Lubavitch as a movement was the most anti-Zionist. In the early part of the 20th century, the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik were the two leading anti-Zionists. So before the state came about, you could have an argument. And you could also argue about what God wants. But Rav Avram says, very similar to Rav Soloveitchik says, if you remember Rav Soloveitchik's famous drasha, in his five drashot, Rav Soloveitchik has to justify in that drasha how he, a Mizrahi, could be a Mizrahi man. After all, he doesn't just come from I wouldn't even say Aguda. His family wasn't Aguda. His family was more to the right of Aguda. How he could become a Mizrahi when he comes from a tradition of anti-Zionism. He really, I will say that Rav Soloveitchik doesn't give you the entire truth here, because his father really became a Mizrahiite in practice, if not in theory. He was teaching at the Tachamoni, so it's not as if his entire family is Mizrahi. His uncle, of course, was anti-Zionist, his grandfather was, but his father, perhaps took the first steps, and the Rav leaves that out. I'm not sure why. But it's true, the Rav did begin himself as an Agudist, and he says what gives him the theological right to break with his family tradition, that when it came to the Zionism, the State of Israel, it's no longer about rabbis arguing. God himself has decided which position is correct. And the Rav develops this idea. This is a psak from God himself. And Rav Avram says the same thing. Before the state, you could argue. Now that we have a state, it's obvious. We see what God wants. God wants Jews to come to Israel. There's yeshivas in Israel, everything else. The fact that the state came to be against all odds, and has been victorious against all these terrible wars, that in and of itself is proof that this is what Kadosh Baruch Hu wants. Well, no, Menachem, he could just say he broke with family tradition, but he doesn't want to just say that. And he's had great, if you look in the new book that was published, the book of his interviews, he wants to put Rav Chaim Soloveitchik also into some sort of quasi-Zionist role. He doesn't want to just say he broke with his family tradition, because who's he to break with Reb Chaim? Does he have, as they say, the shoulders to break with his Reb Chaim, his uncle? But God can break with Reb Chaim, and God himself decided the answer. That's, I think, the justification of the logic he uses in that drasha. He wants to show that it's not just the Mizrahi rabbis on their own. God himself agrees with the Mizrahi, so therefore you have Joseph, the singular brother, in this case Joseph Soloveitchik, you could say, versus the majority of the brothers, and yet God himself decides with that. Okay, let me go on. Rav Avram says, the history of the state of Israel, and he's talking about it in the 1970s when he wrote this, shows that the Netziv was correct. From the Talitz to Yehuda Berlin, and those who shared his viewpoints that when it comes to settling the land and building up the land, we cooperate with everyone, even the non-religious. And Rav Avram says, the problem we have is that some people are just not honest. They're not able to admit that they were wrong. They made a mistake. Some were able to admit it. The bells are ready, by the way, when he came to Israel. When he made it through miracles and all sorts of other things. There's been books, there could be a movie about the Belzer Rebbe's escape to Israel. According to one version of the story, a chassid actually took the Rebbe's place and was killed in place of the Rebbe. When he came to Israel, he told Rav Shalom Nassan Ra'anan, the son-in-law of Rav Kook, that until we came to the land of Israel, we didn't see what was here, we were wrong. Because the Belzer Rebbe was one of the leading opponents of Zionism. And we have other people who acknowledge that they were wrong. He has a letter. Rav Avram, this letter is found in this Sefer, Aschalta He, Volume 2, by Rabbi Yitzhak Dadon, who we've spoken about, the one who killed the terrorist at Merkaz Harav. And he reprints Rav Avram Shapiro's letter to a confused student, another student. And he says, your problem is that Ikarei Emuna, the basics of our faith, are just closed to you. You're not willing to open your mind. And he develops the idea, the fact that the Haredi position was that you have all these non-religious, you have a non-religious government. Rav Avram says, Medinat Yisrael einena shel Ben Gurion v'chaverav. Medinat Yisrael does not belong to Ben Gurion and the other, his friends and the other ministers. Ela shel Kol Yisrael. It's the Jewish peoples. And therefore,
and then he goes on to say. So we're getting some feedback. The fact that it's.
Your speaker's on. And you're going to say, well, what about the non-religious and who are involved in running the government? Why is that significant, he says? In the days of the First Temple, no one would have thought to say that it was not considered a Jewish kingdom, even though there was ruled by wicked people. Elijah would run to Ahav. There was Yeravam II, so we have all sorts of others. Let me read you what he says. It says about Yeravam II. Vayasa Rabbein Hashem. He did evil in God's eyes, and yet it also says to him, Hu Eishivet Gvul Yisrael. He did, and the Navi describes many other things they did, good things he did. Rav Avram says the Medinat Yisrael, the state of Israel, in Bayit Rishon, the first temple, was of Klal Yisrael, not Yeravam and his colleagues. In other words, as long as it's a Jewish kingdom, not ruled by non-Jews, the fact that the rulers are not religious, they could even be evil, doesn't take away from the fact that it's a Jewish kingdom. And he concludes this letter and says, if this is not clear to someone, you have to say, Hu Saris Ruchani Gamur, that this person is, he's really lacking spiritually very much. He's a spiritual eunuch. And Rav Avram goes on to say, with this type of closed-mindedness, you can even come to kitzutz mnetuot. You can even come to the place where you're just about at heresy. For example, those who say that all the miracles in the state of Israel are really from the Satan. And this he's referring to the Satmar Rav. The Satmar Rav had a problem. You know, look at what happened in the state of Israel, all the wars, everything that's happened, and he develops this idea. It's almost a dualistic notion that it's the Masa Satan, that the Satan, that evil forces have real power, that there's evil incarnate in the world that is given free rein to wreak havoc, which strikes as almost an idolatrous notion. And Rav Avraham Shapiro says, let me read you just his words here about this idea of the Satma Rav. He says this, for anyone who says that this is a demonic source. Okay, let me see what you got here. No, I do not believe that they think we can learn Hashgachah lessons from Tanakh without the filter of Tanakh. I would say you're right about that. Nevertheless, it's hard to see Rav Avraham Shapiro as modern in any significant sense, although the ideas that I've been putting forth now, I think many in the so-called modern Orthodox world will find them very attractive. Why do I say it's hard to see him as, quote, modern? Well, for example, he can also say, in an article on Torah study and women, that a woman's nature is not intended for the study of Torah in all of its aspects, like a man is. In other words, a man's intellectually is equipped to handle Torah study in all areas and all forms, but a woman's nature is not intended for that. That's funny. You hear all this talk about how women are superior to men and all that, more spiritual. You don't get that in the Haredi world. I can show you Haredi texts that mock this idea. After all, if a man is the only one who's learning Torah, how can you possibly say a woman's more spiritual? The woman doesn't learn Torah. Only the man learns Torah. So, of course, the man is more spiritual. I understand when they're doing their apologetics, they won't say that. They might do the reverse. But in their internal literature, there's never even a havamim, never even a question that the man is more spiritual and close to Hashem. But Rav Avraham himself was not, I'm not going to say he's dogmatic about this, because Rabbi Neria Gutel, who now is the dean of the Orot Women's College, an enormous Talmud Chacham and also a scholar, he spoke to Rav Avraham personally about a very intelligent woman who was motivated, and Rav Avraham said that there's no problem teaching her anything. So, it could be that Rav Avraham Shapiro's position is maybe no different than Rav Hershel Schechter's position that I've heard also, that in theory, there's nothing wrong with women learning, but the idea that we develop a curriculum for women as a general rule that all women learn Gemara, no, we do like the Rambam says. If there's a woman who shows exceptional promise, who wants to learn, then you teach her. But the idea that Rav Soloveitchik thought that you develop a school where every woman learns Gemara, after all, what does a woman need to learn Bava Betzia for? That would be Rav Avraham Shapiro's attitude. Let me see what you say here. Israel, okay. I know that's the argument, but it's not taken seriously, Barak, but it's not taken seriously in the Haredi circles, because then you're making it seem like learning Torah is somehow a punishment. On the contrary, it's the greatest gift that men can learn Torah. It's a woman can't learn Torah, their attitude is. The idea that how can anyone possibly become as spiritual, reach the height of spirituality without learning Torah, that totally demotes what Torah study is. So I know what they say, but I'm telling you what they say. There's a difference between what they say publicly and what they say in the Sforim, in the internal sources. No one says that among Yeshiva Bachrim don't say that among themselves. They don't believe that. Yeah. Okay, let's go on. Now, Rav Avraham came to the United States a couple times after he became Chief Rabbi. The Chief Rabbis always come to the United States. Truth be told, I never was on the plane, so I don't know how they come, whether they come as royalty, like these Hasidic Rebbes who came to the five towns last Shabbos. Do they travel first class, or do they just come in coach? I don't know. But he came to the United States, and on the first occasion, he was with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, also the chief rabbi. We've now covered all the former chief rabbis, with the exception of Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who we will get to, obviously, in the future, unfortunately. He's very ill now. He needs a refuah shlema. They went to see the Lubavitch Rebbe on the first trip, and their conversations are recorded in a sefer called B'tzel HaChachma. It's a very fascinating book. They must have taped it, of various rabbanim, probably about 30 different, 20 or 20 or 30 different rabbis who came to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and records their conversations. And some of the conversations are really meaningless conversations. It's just, how are you? How are you? Nothing significant. I think the only reason they recorded there is to show the type of people who were coming to visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe, including some Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. Yes, not to be confused with... there's the Shelz of Tshuvas, there's also the biography we spoke about of Rabbi Rakoff, which is called Vetzel HaChachma. But the discussions of Rav Avram Shapiro Mordechai Yahu and Lubavitcher Rebbe go on for many pages, probably about 40, 50 pages. One of the things that the Rebbe spoke to them about was the need to have Kabbalah, study Kabbalah in the yeshivas. I'm sure all of you know that Kabbalah is not studied in the yeshivas, not in the Litvashi yeshivas. I guess they study Hasidus in the Hasidic yeshivas, so that maybe that qualifies. It's not studied in the Sephardic yeshivas as far as I know either. And I was surprised to see that Rav Avram Shapiro went along with it, although he doesn't think it'll be successful. The Rebbe wants Rav Mordechai Eliyahu or Rav Avram Shapiro to come out with a proclamation to start studying Kabbalah in the yeshivas. And the Rebbe speaks about, I'm reading in front of me now, that from the days of the Ari, Kabbalah is not supposed to be hidden, it's supposed to be public. That's not significant to hear the Rebbe say it. We understand that that's Chabad's position and others in that world's position. But to hear Rav Avram Shapiro, a Litvak, say that he agrees, on the other hand, he's not a typical Litvak, because he was very close to the Elyashev family, and Rav Elyashev's grandfather was a great Makubo. And there were, of course, Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap, who becomes Rosh Yeshiva Merkaz after Rav Kook. He believed in the study of Kabbalah. So I think that Rav Avram is reflecting that, although it was never, as far as I know, officially part of the curriculum, yet it was studied. Anyone who went to study with the Nazir was exposed to Kabbalah. Anyone who studied with Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap was exposed to Kabbalah. But there was never actually a shiur, as far as I know, on Kabbalah per se in the yeshiva. At Rav David Cohen's house, there definitely was shiurim dealing with Kabbalah. Let's move on. One of Rav Avram's, I'm sorry also, I know many of you are putting comments. We only had, 20 people on. It was very easy for me to answer all of them. I feel that on every point that I've made here, we could spend an entire 50 minutes discussing this point with sources and all sorts of things. But then it'd be almost like the Chavetz Chaim Yeshiva, where you never go anywhere. You just stay in place. A lot of depth, but we got to move forward also. So I'm sorry I don't get to anything. If you think it's important and I just missed it, which is possible, email it to me and I'll deal with it at the beginning of next class. One of Rav Avraham's important steps as chief rabbi was acceptance of brain death as halachic death, which allowed for organ transplants. I'm sure you all know that you really can't do organ transplants without an acceptance of brain death, because the heart still needs to be beating, the organs still need to be working, and therefore brain death becomes vital for halachic death. And there are many gedolim who support halachic death, brain death as halachic death. Just go to the HODS.org, I think it is, Halachic Organ Donor Society, and you can see them. But until then, this was not official policy. This was Rav Moshe's position, if you accepted Rav Tendler's understanding of it. There were comments that Rabbi Soloveitchik held the same way, but no major figures had supported this. Rav Avram Shapiro pushed through in the Chief Rabbinical Council. Rav Shaul Yisraeli was involved. He wrote an essay describing this. So the Israeli Chief Rabbinate comes down on the side of brain death. Since then, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg has supported. Rav Vadi Yosef, of course, is the most significant supporter of brain death. Rav Shlomo Amar. Those are rabbis in Nakadolim. I don't know. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg is a gadol. Rav Amar is a gadol. Rav Shapiro is a gadol, Rav Shaul Yisraeli is a gadol. You are correct that of the pictures, almost all the pictures are rabbis, not gadolim. On the other hand, there are gadolim there. I tell you that the Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Nachum Rabinovich are just as great gadolim as any of the people who in the Haredi world are regarded as leader of the entire world, Rosh Kol B'nei Hagolah or anything like that. You certainly have gadolim, but yes, you are right. And you even have female rabbis. I don't know if they're not called rabbis, but female Jewish leaders on there. But you are correct. But I'll tell you as well that there are many great Rabbanim, even Gedolim, who accept brain death and whose picture is not on that site because they don't want to go public. I know this because I was told by the guy who runs it, Ravi Berman, that there are people who privately will tell him, you know, you have, if you're in the Haredi world and you think brain death is fine, nothing wrong with it, you can't publicly say this in most cases. Your children are going to not be able to get the shiduchim. The Yated Neman will take away the rabbi from your name. You'll be ostracized. So I know for a fact that there are people in the Haredi world who support this, not even theoretically, practically, but they won't say so publicly. If you look, I mentioned in my last Sfarim blog poster, it was the second to last one, I gave the link how Yated Neman, during the Aseres Yemei Tshuva, discusses a brain death, and they won't even acknowledge that there's anyone of standing who holds who accepts brain death. And if you're interested, brain death, you have Rabbi Shafran's interview there, which I think his name is Shafran, in which he describes the Rosh Homa Zalman Arbach. But it's because of this, Rav Avraham Shapiro and his tenure as chief rabbi, that brain death became accepted by the chief rabbinate. This had enormous implications in the state of Israel. The problem in Israel is many people, you still need to convince them of the significance of this. People die, we know, all the time because there's not enough organs, and people just are not aware of the issue. Rav Avraham also accepted the other great issue, or one of the other great issues, was Ethiopian Jewry. Ethiopian Jewry, the great Aliyah of Operation Moses, happened during Rav Avraham Shapiro when he was chief rabbi, and what to do about the Ethiopian Jews. This is not a new concern, obviously. This goes back to the 19th century, but it never really was a pressing issue. You had a few Ethiopians in Israel. You had different psukim from the chief rabbis, but it wasn't a big, we're not having big numbers here. So now all of a sudden we have thousands of people coming. What's their status? Well, Rav Moshe Feinstein had been asked this question not too long before that. And the answer he gave was that despite the fact that the Radbaz, Rav David ben Zimra, normally, you can't dispute the Radbaz. I don't think you consider the Radbaz an Acharon. I think the Radbaz is regarded as a Rishon, maybe the last of the Rishonim, the generation before the Shulchan Aruch. The Radbaz had said, in no uncertain terms, that the Ethiopian Jews are Jews. Of course, the problem is that the Radbaz said that they're descended from the tribe of Dan. Now, no one bothered asking the Ethiopian Jews if they're descended from the tribe of Dan. They'd be the first ones to tell you they're not descended from the tribe of Dan. They don't think so at all. They have their own story about this. This goes back to a legend by Eldad Hadani, some traveler who created, really a fraud, if you want to know the truth. And this in Rav Avad Yosef, when he poskened that they were complete Jews, he was not chief rabbi at this time. So this is just a private psak, very influential, but didn't bind the Israeli government. He relies completely on the Radbaz. And you can look in another Sfarim blog post. I quoted what David Berger told me, and I dealt with this. What do you do if you're just a regular person like us, and you know that the Radbaz doesn't know what he's talking about when he says that they're from the tribe of Dan? And you know, therefore, that Rav Avadya Yosef's psak is incorrect factually. Yet, can you still rely on the psak because Rav Avad Yosef is a gadol? Not just a gadol, he's the gadol hador. When I say he's the gadol hador, don't start throwing at me other people. I tell you that in 50 years, in 30 years, no one's going to be reading Rav Yosef Svarim. And yet, in 500 years, they're going to be reading Rav Avad Yosef Svarim. That's what I mean when I say he's the gadol hador. And we can't get into it now. We've spoken in previous classes. Does this make sense to say that you can follow a position which you think is incorrect? Well, Rav Moshe Feinstein states about the Radbaz that although the Radbaz says this, perhaps the Radbaz didn't have all the facts. That's a polite way of saying, I think, that Rav Moshe looked into it, and this idea that the Radbaz has, that they're from the tribe of Dan, as I said, first of all, they don't say they are. Rav Moshe Sternbach, in his discussion, he looked in the Encyclopedia Britannica, he tells us. And therefore, Rav Moshe says that they are not Jewish, and we have to convert them. Although we should save them, we have to convert them. We can't marry them. Rav Avram Shapiro has a completely different perspective on this. Elda Hadani was. This is where the legend of. He's quoted, by the way, by the Gaonim, Elda Hadani, certain Gaonim. But this is where the idea that they're from the tribe of Dan comes from. They think that they're descended from the Queen of Sheba. They have their own history there. But what does Rav Avram Shapiro say? Rav Avram Shapiro's psak, and this became the psak of the chief rabbinate, was that you do a giur l'chumra. You give the Ethiopians giur as a stringency. You don't have to give them any brit milah, not even hatafatam. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rav Shmuel Salant, and others had ruled in different cases that if someone is given brit milah with the intention to circumcise them, but then you find out later the person is not Jewish, you do not need to do hatafatam brit. Just immersion in the mikvah is enough. Even though the person's not Jewish, you don't need to do a tapadam. Normally we say they actually have to take some blood, but there's a psak, as I said, not just for Tzvi Pesach, going back to Rav Shmuel Salant, you don't have to, so the chief rabbinate ruled, you just do send them to the mikvah, and it's a chumrah. And you can even say things like, you know, it's a chance to reunite with the Jewish people. But what about Rav Moshe Feinstein's point that maybe the Radbaz didn't have all the facts? You know, this idea that they're from the tribe of Dan, you're not going to find any historian or anthropologist or anything, or even an Ethiopian Jew, who's going to take this seriously. This is what Rav Avram Shapiro says. And in this is a sense, really, although it might get us where we want to go, because we want to accept Ethiopian Jews as Jews and not have any problems with it, with their reuniting with the Jews, this is really an anti-modern psak of Rav Avram Shapiro, and an anti-modern justification. So, as I said, all the modern Orthodox Jews, they might love the result. They certainly cannot love the way he gets to it, because it goes against the entire ethos of modern Orthodoxy and how they look at sources. This is a quote. The decisions of the chief rabbinate do not depend on articles or mechkarim or researches of researchers of chokrim, afilu toraniim, even Torah researchers, even rabbis, who've done research, but only on matters of psak halacha. The poskim, who are the amude yesod, those poskim upon whom halacha is based, and everything else are only matters of theory and conjecture. When the early rabbis, is referring to the Radbaz, when they write a psak halacha, we apply to them the rabbinic expression that the early ones are like angels. And Ruach HaKodesh was upon them. And if they wrote something, and it remains for generations, that's a sign that they had the Siyata Deshmaya, the assistance of heaven, and the Radbaz and the Mari Castro state explicitly that the Ethiopian Jews are Jews. So don't come to me and say that maybe, you know, we can prove from research that they didn't know, and that maybe the Radbaz didn't have the facts. Rav Avram Shapiro says, in matters of halacha, we only look at halachic sources. We do not look at outside sources. Well, I mean, this is a real problem from my perspective, because what do you mean you only look at halachic sources? When a posek decides something, he decides a question of electricity, of any scientific question. He knows only as much as the outside sources that he knows, either how much he's told or how much he's researched. So if the Radbaz asked around and he was told that they're from the tribe of Dan, how can you say that we're not concerned with what his sources are, unless you have this assumption, or if Avram does, that a posek of the stature of the Radbaz, we simply don't go there. We don't assume that he could be in error about such a basic psak as determining yichus. Yet Rav Moshe was not so certain. Rav Moshe said that maybe he didn't have all the facts. So I think it's quite fascinating, this dispute. Giur HaChumra, can they marry Kohanim? It's a good point. Most of the Ethiopians, I'll tell you, did not even go through the Giur HaChumra, because Rav Shlush in Netanya announced, and this is Rav Avadia's position also, that they don't need to do any Giur. And if they came to him as the chief rabbi of a city, he would marry them without any Giur, without anything. So many of them went to him. Could they marry a Kohen? It's a good question. I don't know. Among other important responses that Rav Avram Shapiro wrote, I think it's the previous Tzvandov, that the Metzias doesn't matter. In other words, how do we know Metzias? We know Metzias through research. But when Metzias comes up against Halacha, okay, I guess you know, it's probably the second. The Halacha trumps the Metzias. Rav Avram would be the first one to say that you need Metzias. How can you decide any question without it? But here we have a case where, first of all, it's not fact, he's saying. It's only speculation. We're not dealing with a scientific fact in front of us. We're dealing with scholars explaining where the Ethiopians came from. So even if you can be 99.9% sure, you're not 100% sure, who are you to say that the Radboz is absolutely incorrect? And so if you have reasonable arguments on the one hand, and you have the Radboz on the other, you go with the Radboz. I guess that's how you read it, probably. One more point of Halacha. He wrote a responsum permitting the Samaritans to convert. Again, conversion l'chumra. And there is no problems with their yichus, with their lineage, and this is followed by the Bate Din, by the courts in Israel to this day. Actually, I see I only have half a page, so we'll continue. We'll finish up with Rav Avram. When Rav Kook was defamed, when he was chief rabbi and he was defamed in the land of Israel, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein and Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, the two most important Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, sent out a public letter of protest about those people who defamed Rav Kook. You can see it in the book, Letters to Rav Kook. Rav Moshe Mordechai accompanied Rav Kook when he came to America to raise money for the yeshivas. Rav Moshe Mordechai was the Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron. Rav Avram Shapiro was one of the great Iluyim to come out of Hebron. And yet when Rav Avram Shapiro died, was his death even mentioned in the Hebron Yeshiva? Were any of the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hebron, of the Haredi world, Hebron Yeshiva or otherwise, the men who weren't with Hebron at his funeral, were men who weren't with Hebron, were any of them at his funeral? Were any of the Haredi Dayanim, who now have left Dayanus, were they at his funeral? They ignored him. If you're looking at Tei Naaman, that week, he died the same week as another Haredi Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Avram Shapiro, whose funeral had something like, 60, 70,000 people. It was a huge funeral, blocked all the streets. There was, 10 lines explaining that Rabbi Avram Shapiro, Rosh Yeshiva, America's Rav, died. Traffic was blocked at all sorts of places. That's the Haredi world today, unfortunately. And it's even worse for people who came from that world, like Rav Avram Shapiro, who we said last week, the Dov Wiedenfeld proclaimed that he would be the Gadol Hador, even though in B'nai Brak, they might not accept that, he would be the Gadol Hador. Now, in the United States, he didn't have the same influence like he had in Israel. We spoke in previous classes how his influence in Israel is enormous in the religious Zionist world, and especially the Chardal world. Well, why not? Well, in America, first of all, we don't have any religious Zionists in America. People call themselves religious Zionists, but what does religious Zionism mean in America? It means we go to the Israeli Day Parade and we give money. The real religious Zionists are living in Israel. And the rabbis who would put forth his teachings and things of that nature, they're in Israel. Who are the rabbis in America? The people who came out of YU or the Haredi world. So he doesn't have the influence in America that he had in Israel for obvious reasons. He doesn't have the followers to spread it. I will tell you that the principal of the Kushner School in Livingston, Rabbi Rubin, he used to be at Ramaz. He was a close Talmud of Avram Shapiro and even served as a secretary to him when he was chief rabbi. Yeah. We all know that in the United States, we're intertwined with the Haredi world. We have Haredi rabbis at our shuls, teaching in our schools, so the Haredi worldview affects us, and they're obviously not going to take kindly to Rav Avram Shapiro's position. We have Haredi kollels funded in their entirety by modern Orthodox people. None of this happens in Israel. There's a complete separation between the two communities. A religious Zionist community would never dream of having a Haredi come be a Rosh Kollel or influence the students. So therefore, Rav Avram Shapiro, his students, which are now found, we know, in the Tzohar movement, and not just in the Chardal movement, but even in the mainstream religious Zionist movement, Rav Aviner and that crowd, although Rav Aviner broke with Rav Avram Shapiro, his influence in Israel was enormous. Whether it will remain enormous remains to be seen. His son, who took over Merkaz, is nowhere near his caliber. And it remains to be seen whether the Chardal movement as a whole has legs as we go forward. But certainly when we write the history of the Chardal movement, which we spoke so much about in previous classes, Rav Avram Shapiro has to be front and center. So with that, we will end tonight. If we have time, we have about 15 minutes. If anyone has questions or want to send things in or something I didn't get to, I'll take a chance to do it now.
Everyone's mic is live if you want to have an audio discussion.
Just send the question in. It might be easier. Judah in Toronto. I don't know. I don't know about that. I think everyone on the HODS website believes that brain death is death. That's the whole point of the website. Father says that he doesn't use the term armchair Zionist. He says that Zionists in America are philanthropists. That is, we're Zionists if we give money. If you ride around the five towns or places like Teaneck, you'll see lots of cars that have bumper stickers, Chevron. I think the people in Chevron would be much happier. I said this before. If the people in Teaneck would be in Chevron with bumper stickers that said Teaneck, than being in Teaneck with bumper stickers that say Chevron. But that's the American Zionist movement. Oh, this is going back, Yisrael, to the previous classes. He comes from the Chevron yeshiva. Sir Rav Zalman Meltzer, he was very close to the Chazon Ish. He started with Rav Zalman Meltzer, they moved into Chevron, so you have Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, and the later in the Chevron yeshiva. Hold on for another minute or so, because I know there's probably some people typing. I assume you mean Bundes, Stanny. His view on secular studies. Rav Avram Shapiro, I think, was like a typical Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. That secular studies are fine. After you become a great Torah scholar, you need to get secular studies to get a job. On your free time, you want to read them. He put secular studies in, as we spoke about last semester, in Merkaz for the Teachers Institute. But this is not something you do when you're studying in yeshiva. Just like the Netziv said, that we're not dealing with some fanaticism here. It's not that secular studies are evil or devilish. They have a time and a place, but when you study Torah, you need to devote yourself entirely to Torah study, and that secular studies are, for the most part, just going to be of utilitarian nature, but plenty of Rav Avram Shapiro students went off to university, became even professors, and they're respected in that world. When you move into the breakaway, the Har Hamor world of Rav Tau, then you start getting into real sectarian type of ideology, where secular studies, almost like a Haredi view, secular studies are evil. That's not the typical. Merkaz HaRav was a typical Lithuanian yeshiva. That's how Ritzi Yehuda always wanted it. We dealt with the break with Rav Tau in detail in a previous class. Rav Avram was very close to Rav Gorin. Not only was he close, as I mentioned last time, he was one of the people who signed the Langer tshuva. He was one of the people that supported the decision of the Langer Dayanim. He was one of the Dayanim, the anonymous Dayanim, to allow the Langers to marry in the Mamzeres case. And much of Rav Avram Shapiro's family is still in the Haredi world. He comes from that world. He could have very easily been a Rosh Yeshiva in Chevron or Ponevez or anything like that. Okay, thank you, Judah. I'll take a look at that. No, this is not this is a B'nai Brak view. In the Merkaz world, you don't wait till you're flat out broke. You learn in yeshiva. When you're done with yeshiva, you go to the army, and then you get a parnasa. If you're able to stay in yeshiva longer, you stay in longer. There's no ideology here that everyone has to stay for the rest of their life in yeshivas. That's like a B'nai Brak type of ideology. It was understood in Merkaz, when you're done learning, you learned for many years. Big Talmid Chacham, you went to the army, then you got a job. If you were very talented, you became a Rav. You taught. There's a kol Merkaz, and they opened up various yeshivas in settlements. but the average graduate of America's ended up either working in a kibbutz or going to the university and getting a job. It's a typical old-time Lithuanian yeshiva. I would say before the change in the 1970s, when the Lithuanian yeshivas became places where you just stay forever and that there's something wrong with making a living, earning a living. Okay, so don't see anything else. Would I say it closer to true Lita? Look, on one hand, it's hardly like Lita in that you have this Zionistic vision, which in Lithuania you didn't have a Zionistic vision, but the curriculum was a Lithuanian curriculum with additions put in by Rav Kook, Machshava. When I say it's a Lithuanian yeshiva, it's because the focus on Talmud, the non-Hasidic element, Ritzi Yehuda, was very strong in not allowing Hasidus into the yeshiva. But really, it was no different than Mary. The only difference, if you went in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, before the Six-Day War, the only difference, really, between Merkaz and Chevron was that Merkaz was more Zionistic and they studied Rav Kook. The Chevron yeshiva also. What do you think the Chevron yeshiva graduates did? They became Supreme Court justices and lawyers and doctors. Chevron can't even advertise all their graduates because they're embarrassed by them now. Danny Sperber, Professor Tushma, all that. I mean, the Chevron yeshiva was no different than Merkaz. You're thinking today, this is not the Lithuanian yeshiva world of years ago. This is a new world that was created really from the 1970s on because of the Israeli government funding. The Chevron yeshiva was full of regular people who, after learning in yeshiva, they went out. They went to the army. They got jobs. This is not the Lithuanian yeshiva world which you have today. This is not Lithuania at all. I'm going to do a Sfarim blog post about someone's memoirs, Rosh Yeshiva's memoirs from Lithuania. You'll see this, and I'm not referring. You can see, read the book from this rabbi from Baltimore. But what you have today is not what Lithuania is like at all. It's nothing to do with Lithuania. It's a creation of a new type of. It's a society of lomdim, of learners. Yeah, he went to Kol Torah, but he also was in Chevron. Wasn't he in Chevron? I'm certain he was in Chevron. I'll check on that. I know he went to Kol Torah. He spoke about this when he was in Toronto. We'll have to come back to that next time. I'm thinking about what change. Let me just say briefly. Israeli government funds all this. So if you could, what happened was when it became possible to sit and learn permanently, and then it became an ideal. Now, what drove the ideal was they didn't want to go to the army. When this ideal first began to be pushed, had the yeshiva bachrim been able to get jobs without going to the army, they would have. But then, when they couldn't go to the army, and the government is allowing them to stay in yeshiva by supporting them, then it became an ideal. So that today, if the Israeli government would say you can go to work, but you don't have to go to the army, I think many of them would still stay in yeshiva. The rabbi of Baltimore is Polyakov. He wrote a book called Minhagei Lita. It has a lot of problems, but you get a sense of some of what it was like in the Lithuanian world. Okay, with that, I see it's already 10 after 10. We'll break tonight. Please, if there's things you want to say, email me. I'll get back to them next class. We will begin next Monday night, same time, with Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan. We leave the world of the land of Israel, leave the world of the Ashkenazi and the Lithuanian yeshiva world, and return to the world of Sfaradim, the world of Italy, where I think he'll be a very interesting person. Do I intend to cover Yisrael Meir Lau? His life story is fascinating, amazing. There's nothing there in terms of intellectual content to speak about. He's not a thinker. He's not a posek, so I don't know. But I will look. And maybe I can pull out some stuff from his books. But he's not known as an intellectual. He's more in the sense of a doer, and he accomplished more as chief rabbi than anyone, I think, other than Rav Herzog. And if you haven't read his autobiography, I don't know why it hasn't been translated to English. I encourage all of you to. It's incredible, to put it mildly. But it's the same reason I said about Rivar and Cutler. I don't know if there was much in the way of ideas to speak about, but I'll give it a shot. And truthfully, with Rivar and Cutler, there have now been a few articles on him. I will come back to Rivar and Cutler. Okay, good night, everyone.